Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Gail Seiler, your host for today's show. Hello to you, the listener, and thanks for tuning in today. We've had some wild weather this past week, but it looks like we'll have a sunny weekend, but it's going to be cold. Those of us hoping for snow, we may have to wait a little bit longer. We've got two very interesting stories for you today, and we'll be playing a little holiday music. Later in the show, we'll hear from Carolyn Isaacs, who is the program director of the American Friends Service Committee in Arizona. She was in Iowa last week, speaking in several locations about who profits from immigrant detention and mass incarceration, and what Iowans should know about that as we head into the caucuses. But first, we'll hear from a group called Run DSM, who did a presentation at ISU a few weeks ago. Run DSM was started by two Des Moines teachers, Emily Lang and Christopher Rollins. We'll hear them speaking in a minute about how the program started and how it has grown. I assume their name, Run DSM, is a takeoff on Run DMC, the group from New York who played a role in getting hip-hop to be more widely heard in the 80s. But back to Run DSM from Des Moines. Their website says that the mission of Run DSM is to support and empower students on their journey to becoming community-based activists and to shift the perception of youth by allowing them a greater part in the conversation for change. The core of the program is where students write and perform poems. I've heard the young people from Run DSM perform, and I was just blown away by their talent and honesty. In my other role, other than being a volunteer at KHOI, I teach in the School of Education at ISU. And I really wanted our future teachers to learn about Run DSM and to hear from both the youth and their teachers. So we asked them to come to campus and to speak to students in our multicultural education classes. And they did. They came and they spoke to about 100 future teachers. Emily Lang and Christopher Rollins, the teachers who started the organization, spoke about the pedagogy and principles of Run DSM, and they brought three of their students, who are poets, to share their knowledge and their truth. Those are the words they use on their website and in talking about the work that they do. The students who we'll be hearing from are James Reesby, Jaleesa Johnson, and Elandra Brazel. First, the teachers who started the program introduce themselves and tell about the main goals of Run DSM, which is based in the principles of hip-hop culture.
I'm in my 13th year of teaching, which is really hard to believe. My path started at Indiana University, where I majored in history. I did focus heavily on African-American history during my undergrad studies because of the environment that I grew up in Indiana. If you go to Google and type in the word lynching, the most famous image that will come up is the town that I grew up in Marion. So if you wonder, why is this white male interested in black history? It's because I come from a place that is doused in that history, that is shaped in that history, which led to my interest. And then I went to the University of Alabama for grad school, where I got my master's degree in secondary education, curriculum, and instruction. And my focus was pairing history standards to the elements of hip-hop. That's me. That's who I am. That's where I come from. I've taught history, all social sciences, and literacy in my time in Des Moines Public Schools.
Hey, my name's Emily Lang. I'm the other half of Run DSM. I received my undergrad and graduate degrees from Drake University. I have endorsements to teach English, rhetoric, and theater. And then my master's degree is in effective teaching. And we're here to talk to you about Run DSM. Run DSM is an organization within Des Moines Public Schools, and it was founded in 2010 at Harding Middle School. At the time, Christopher and I were both hired at Harding Middle School.
Yeah, we were there to address literacy needs. We knew that the traditional approach was not working with our students. So we created Run DSM, which we call kind of a for youth, by youth movement. And what we mean by that is there's a lot of conversations taking place about youth but youth are oftentimes not involved in the conversation. There's a lot of people that tell youth how they should be, what they should be interested in, what they should be studying, but youth are hardly invited to the table to provide their perspective. So what we wanted to do was to create a platform to say the youth of your city are extremely talented, they're extremely articulate, they just might not be in the way that a traditional public school recognizes it. So we are here to kind of put that in your face a little bit and to say these youth aren't apathetic. They actually really care about social issues and things that are happening to them. If you just took the time to listen, you might actually be surprised at what they can say and what they are capable of doing. So that's kind of how we got started, and we've exploded since then.
The other reason why we really wanted to start this movement was because when people ask me where I taught, and I told them Harding Middle School, a lot of people would say, oh, bless you. Those kids really need you. I hear it's really, really rough around there. And the thing that really bothered myself and Christopher was that these people that would say these things never walked into our building. They never saw the students that we were working with. They labeled them at risk. They labeled them troubled. And really, they were some of the brightest minds in the city. They just hadn't been given an opportunity. And so we wanted to find a way to remove those labels from them. Stop calling them at risk, stop calling them trouble, and really just give them the proper platform and voice that they deserve.
That was Emily Lang and Christopher Rollins talking about Run DSM, a program that they started in the Des Moines Public Schools. Just to give some more information on Run DSM, Emily and Christopher explained that the program began with one small idea, having students get up on a stage and read poems written by other people. They wanted to give them, to use their words, a space in classrooms to speak their truth. And it has grown into an organization with multiple components. To name a few of the current parts of Run DSM, the core is Movement 515. It started with one student in one school and, as I said, began with students reading poems written by others. And now between 80 and 100 youth participate each week, and they are now writing and performing their own poems. Twice a week in five high schools in Des Moines, students and mentors come together to create spoken word poetry, some of which you're going to hear in a little bit. There are also now courses which are open to all students in the Des Moines school system. The courses are called Urban Leadership 101 and 102. And in these, the students engage in an in-depth study of social movements, and that also includes internships in the community. One thing they do also in that course is to organize a two-day teen summit each year. Run DSM holds weekly graffiti and breakdancing workshops, and high school students from Run DSM run half-pint poetry in 11 elementary schools in Des Moines. And there's also an urban arts camp in the summer where Run DSM youth work with younger children. They're hired by the organization. And Christopher and Emily spoke about the importance of these youth being paid for their expertise and recognized as leaders in this way.
But again, it's taking something that, like, they're already passionate about, right? They're extremely creative with, and now they get to pass that down to young little baby poets. And that's a powerful thing, y'all, because they've now become the role models in their city. Yep. They can go to the grocery store, they can be out and be like, oh, you're a poet in Movement 515 or whatever. So we talk about youth empowerment. That's exactly what we're talking about, right? Finding them spaces, and not only finding them spaces, but getting them paid and letting them to understand that, like, y'all are capable of bringing about change too. And I believe at least two of your three panel members will be future educators, which we're very excited about, right?
Several of the young people from 515 competed in Brave New Voices, the world's largest international spoken word gathering. The team from Run DSM has competed the last 3 years, and this past year, their team was in the top 8 out of 60 teams. So let's hear some. We're going to hear one of the young people now in Movement 515.
Without further ado, let's give it up for Miss Jaleesa Johnson, your first high school poet.
My father has always been a dreamer. He is a refugee of reality, but what do you expect? Black boys have been running for centuries. My father is a veteran. You would think that his years in the Navy would have taught him that fight or flight can both get you killed, would have taught him no matter how fast his feet are moving, they'll never get off the ground. Black boys only get to fly when they meet God. My father told me that he only joined the military because he broke his leg and shattered his athletic scholarship. I can still find pieces of hope in the creases behind his kneecaps and the way he still watches the Cowboys every Sunday. It's the only family tradition he's not afraid of. We all know that black boys and commitment don't go hand in hand. I can still find pieces of hope in the way he wraps his hand around the football before he passes it to my older brother. I've always wished that I could catch something that beautiful, wished that he would pour all of his love and dreams into me, but I have never really been that athletic. The only time that I run is from confrontation, and I knew that when my father came home smelling of gun smoke and alcohol, it was time to lace up my track shoes. My father is a veteran, and we all know that sometimes that goes hand in hand with alcoholic. I wonder if the burn of liquor was easier to swallow than the memories. My father's anger was not always impulsive. Sometimes it sat in his stomach for years. That didn't make it any less explosive. Years in the Navy should have taught him that all bombs go off in time. Miller Lite was my father's catalyst, and when he's drunk, he doesn't care about the casualties. His cannonball fists explode into my mother's mouth as I implode within myself. My father taught me how to be a suicide bomber, and my mother, she taught me how to die quietly. My father is a veteran, but he has been fighting all his life. We all know that black boy and soldier go hand in hand. We all know that black boys die with guns in their hands and nothing in their pockets. We all know that black boys die with nothing in their hands when reaching for their wallets. But I guess that the only identification that the police need is the color of their skin. My father has always hated his skin. He has never found comfort in his shade of brown. Lately, his lungs are becoming as black as he is. My father finds God in cigarettes dipped in battery acid. Says that when he's high, it's the closest he'll ever get to heaven. And that smoke rings remind him that angels are real. My father says marijuana spelled backwards is sanctuary. That life is no fun without a twist. He gets tongue-tied when saying, I love you. And I know that my birth was an accident, but I wish there was a way he could flip my name around so it didn't sound so much like he regretted it. My father and I's relationship is a war, and I am not sure that I can win it. We all know that most black boys don't have fathers around to show them what it looks like to fight for their kids, only have to fight with them. I wish that my father's love was a lifetime enlistment. But we all know that black boys and commitment don't go hand in hand. Maybe it's because the only thing in this world promised to them is a bullet.
That was Jaleesha Johnson, a high school student from Des Moines, with the very powerful poem that she wrote and performed. And you can hear on the clip there the people snapping fingers, which is the common response at spoken word performances where the audience shows support and connection with the words that are being spoken by the performer. This is KHOI, and you're listening to Local Talk. I'm your host, Gail Seiler. We're learning about Run DSM, an organization in Des Moines Public Schools that gives voice to students and values their talents and their lived experiences. Next, we'll hear from Christopher Rollins, one of the Des Moines public school teachers who started this organization, and he's going to describe the philosophy of education that their teaching is based on.
This is our philosophy. The first thing I hope that you notice is the life as primary text, right? Those are the things that we should be studying first. I would argue oftentimes in education we get it twisted, we get it flipped. We go into education because we really enjoy curriculum or content. We should be going in because we want to build relationships with kids, right? That should be the very first thing that you do when they walk in the door. They are the most important thing, right? Not the curriculum, not the content. Their stories are more important. Once you understand their story and what they're about, then you connect that to your curriculum, right? So sometimes you might have to flip that or correct people when they say it the wrong way. So that is why that is in the center of our educational philosophy. As far as redefining literacy, we look at that as a reclaiming of voice that extends beyond just reading, writing, listening, and speaking. How do we get young people to understand who they are? I would argue that in literacy specifically, finding your voice is one of the hardest things that you can do. So that's why we focus so much on the life is primary text, that you can find your voice through your own experiences, and then you can really enhance your abilities. Social justice is in everything that we do. We really use the pedagogy of the oppressed, right? The idea that once we educate our young people on the ways in which they have been oppressed, we can then in turn empower them to make a change for the ways that they've been oppressed. And when we talk about student empowerment, that again goes back to the life is primary text. They're at the center of everything that we do. So as a result of that, we give them mass amounts of power in the space. And I think that the other side of that is, as a teacher, you need to learn how to put your learner hat on, because that relationship is reciprocal. You do not know everything that there is to know about your students, and they don't know everything there is to know about you. So sometimes you have to be willing to give them the power to become your teacher, because sometimes as teachers we think, I have all the knowledge, my job is to then give that knowledge to you, and you regurgitate it. But I'm here to tell you, in the course of a day, there are multitudes of times when you as teacher become learner, and your student is expert, right? So you need to be able to have that in the space to create that. And I think that the last thing, that the community word, we are very familial. If we do any sort of feedback for our classes or our programs, the one word we see over and over and over again is family. Y'all treat us like family. I walk in the door and I feel loved. Or I've never had somebody treat me the way that y'all do. Or I know that every day I come in here, regardless of what I did the day before, you're going to give me a new opportunity. So that's what that community means to us. That's the creation of safe space and the creation of brave space.
This is KHOI, and you're listening to Local Talk. We're hearing the voices of students and teachers who are part of an organization in Des Moines called Run DSM. You cannot miss hearing the passion and commitment in their words and their voice, whether they're talking or performing. So let's hear another student perform their poetry.
We have our next student poet. Please give it up for Mr. James Reedsby.
I speak to those willing to listen, hoping you can see the image I envision. Day to day, it's insane. The cool kid's picking on the little lame light skin because he wears the same hoodie every day. He's 5'5 and overweight. Day after day, it's all the same. They just don't know that he's insane. So he snaps, snatching him down by his book bag, punching him in the face until this rage leaves his veins, and then everything's okay. The day after he's suspended, he walks in the school halls, head high like a convict. But nothing's changed. Everything remained the same. Those hateful things replayed. When he got home, he wrapped the belt around his throat, tightened it until he began to choke, turning blue in the face as he started to fade away. Saved by his little sister, the one that looks up to him to this day. You, unaware of whom you may be, well, that little light-skinned boy, he was me. 11 years of age in the 6th grade, people to this day say there's no way I could have ever been overweight because I'm 6'3". And I'm in amazing shape, and I carry myself, and I've never been ashamed.
All right. Knowing
day after day, the pain still remains. Those hateful things still replay, I pray. No one should feel that pain, but being more spiritual than religious, I don't think he hears me screaming his name. I remain one man with one voice and one brain. Hi, my name is James.
That was James Reedsby, a student in Des Moines Public Schools who is part of Run DSM. The teachers, Emily Lang and Christopher Rollins, said that they never ask students to do something, to be vulnerable and to be honest, unless they are willing to do it themselves. And that includes writing and performing poetry. So here is one of the teachers, Christopher Rollins, with his poem. And then right after that, we'll hear another student, Alondra Brazel.
There is no Crayola set with enough excess depth to stretch to where my inner hues meet breath. Take a whimsical swim through my mind's recess where daily students sit poverty-stricken with dread, vexed and perplexed that they have yet to see a color that represents respect or a history of unforgottenness. Blood red spilled from Malcolm, Martin, and Mega Everett's heads because of how they spoke and how they led. But have you colored me yet? Perhaps you've colored me too pasty to be a poet. or blended false notions of a skin tone in its history of false heroics. I've colored outside the lines my whole life, ridiculed and criticized for writing rhymes because I'm white. They claimed I tried to color myself black, when in fact I was just searching for a creative hue large enough to capture the calamity of this suppressed voice. And poetry knows no hue or shade. It just screams the truth until it's blue in the face. And with further introspection, the connection between wax Crayola sets and wax museum statuettes and fear used as ideological weapons, I'd suspect that I'm a suspect when my skin tone fails to fit those known to spit hip-hop quotables over and over again for future generations that gave a damn about the colors others used to define them and their accomplishments. Have you colored me yet? Thank you. Give it up for Miss Alondra Brazel, y'all. Junior at East Side.
My mother never told me not to depend on a man, so that's how I knew when I came out of her womb I was born with scars. The suicidal bomb to my three nieces. Never let a man define you. I know that boys are hard to control. I know that your body is hard to control. Fingers may not mean anything to you now, but when he touches you, it will feel like heaven. Wait on God to take you. God loves you. But he does give up consequences. Make sure your body is not the sacrifice. Because your soul and this earth were giving up your temple. Do not let a broken man inside of you. The only thing that he can add to your puzzle is broken pieces. Let him be the reason why you were not put together. And please, be put together. Never lose focus. Don't misunderstand me. Not all boys are bad, but they do help create sin. Especially the ones that are looking for their mothers inside of you. Who lose themselves inside of you. Understand me when I say that you will not find your fathers in the scent of the cologne. But make sure you do not leave your scent in the bed sheets. I want you to know that you want more than tight hugs and random flowers. Let him know that you are forced to be reckoned with. That you are blooming flower and a volcano ready to explode. Like the soles of your feet are worth kissing. You are not painting a Mona Lisa, you are painting a Dorothy Dandridge. Believe you'll shine Maya Angelou, roots in his best is golden. The women are born again in you and feed us and respect that. Tell him I instill that in you. To speak like a bomb in the middle of your socket is ready to explode on your tongue. Tell him your art built you like a warrior. Let your words cut so you kill his ego. Let him tell you that you are too strong. Tell him he's not strong enough for you. I mean, in our family, we are silent when it comes to men, but you won't be. You won't be afraid to speak even when you're not spoken to. Even when your lips shake and the ground under you feels like it's going to crumble, speak. Even when your mind goes blank and your body shuts down, speak. Because your voice is the ladder to our freedom. Because as much as they say they like beautiful black girls, they don't. Speak for our beauty and your sanity. Carry us on your back, not like a heavy load, but like a prized possession. And be proud of where you come from. And never forget. But if you're willing to love someone, make sure they come see me first.
That was Des Moines teacher Christopher Rollins and student Alondra Brazel performing their poetry. They're both part of Run DSM, a program that was started by Christopher and Emily Lee Lang in Des Moines. We're hearing segments from a presentation they did at ISU. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you're listening to Local Talk. In this last segment, we hear Emily and Christopher speak directly to the ISU School of Education students who were in the audience about the importance of building relationships and connections between teachers and students.
All of this is great, but if you can't connect with your students and you can't build relationships with them, they're not going to learn anything, and they're not really going to reach their highest potential. We have a kind of a mantra in Run DSM, and it's always lead with love. And a lot of people who maybe know about Run DSM or maybe challenge what we do say, okay, so these students are doing really, really well in your classes or in your programs, but how do they do when they go to other classes? And I can tell you that we really do preach this idea of leading with love, and that we know that our students are going to be faced with teachers who are going to hold all the power, or who are going to not allow them to be experts or give them no power in the classroom. And we just tell them over and over and over, like, the best thing that you can do is just lead with love. Kill that teacher with kindness. Show up every single day with your butt in the seat in the front row and prove them wrong, because the best revenge that you can get is to be successful and to go on to college and get back in those classrooms and become the teacher that you wish you were able to have one day.
The other way to connect is to always make sure that you're speaking your own truth and recognizing other people's truth in the space. Just because I have a truth doesn't mean that truth is universal. right? So I need to be willing to give my students space to speak their truth and to listen to that and to acknowledge it, right? Because their experiences, I mean, I'm a white male. My experiences are way different than a large majority of the students' lives that I've dealt with over the last 13 years, right? That's being real. That's speaking truth. And so by giving them space to speak truth and acknowledging their experiences, it creates a powerful connection between you because they see that I'm not here to compare oppressions or I'm not here to act like my white privilege doesn't exist. And so when we can get down on that level and break down those walls and those barriers, that's what leads to that familial connection, right?
Another thing that's really important is our jobs as educators extend beyond 8 o'clock to 3 o'clock, you know? I mean, it's so important to see yourself as not just a teacher, but as a pivotal person in this young person's life. I mean, every single week we go to a number of school events, or we go to a picnic at one of our kids' family's house, or we're invited to their church, or a number of different things. And it's so important to remember that, like, we are one part of a kid's village. And I know that that sounds cheesy, but it absolutely does take just tons of adults surrounding our young people in order for them to be successful. And it's really important to us that our young people go back to school and then go into those classrooms, and hopefully our daughter gets to have them as a teacher one day.
We
say that to them all the time. Yep. And they take that responsibility really, really seriously. So, you know, you'll sometimes hear people hating on teachers and saying, well, they get breaks and they get summers off, and yeah, we do, but, you know, this is all life's work. Like, it isn't just an 8-to-3 type of job. Like, if you're going to go into education, expect to spend time with young people outside of the classroom. Expect to spend time with their families. Expect them to get to know your kids and your families, because that is truly, truly, truly where those barriers break down and we really can come together. Yeah.
They shared some very powerful message with the future teachers and really important messages for all of us. I want to say thanks to those folks from Run-DSM for coming to ISU and sharing their work and their poems with the students in the School of Education. And also an additional thanks to them for letting us air it on Local Talk so more people could hear the extraordinary work that is being done in Run-DSM in the Des Moines Public Schools and the amazingly talented young people that are part of it. This is KHOI Community Radio, serving the heart of Iowa. And next, we're privileged to play some music that not everyone gets to hear. We'll be listening to Kathleen Rohde. Kathleen is in the music department at ISU and is the director of several women's choirs there. They just had a holiday concert a few weeks ago. If you didn't make it, it was wonderful. And listen for some of their performances in the spring. But now we're going to hear Kathleen Rohde play a holiday song, just her on the piano.
Thank you.
This is KHOI, and you're listening to Local Talk. That was Go Tell It on the Mountain, played by Kathleen Rohde from the Music Department at ISU. We turn now to an important topic that's been in the news lately. Carolyn Isaacs, who is the Arizona Program Director of the American Friends Service Committee, was in Ames last week as part of a speaking tour of Iowa. She spoke at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, and we were there to record what she had to say. She spoke about who profits from immigrant detention and mass incarceration. Her talk was part of efforts that the American Friends Service Committee is making in Iowa, an initiative called Governing Under the Influence, whose goal is to expose and question the role and power of corporate money in impacting government policies and elections. And now we'll be listening to some of Carolyn Isaacs' talk. In the beginning of her talk, she spoke about the growing prison industry in the U.S. and makes connections between incarceration and immigrant detention.
I am the program director at the American Friends Service Committee office in Tucson, Arizona. And our work there is all criminal justice all the time. And so in Arizona, if you're working to, our overall goal is to reduce the number of people incarcerated in the state of Arizona. So, of course, that includes looking at our sentencing laws and trying to change our policies to send fewer people, to keep them for less time, and to really look at alternatives to incarceration that, as it turns out, work better and cost less. But in a state like Arizona, you can't be working on criminal justice without bumping up against the for-profit incarceration industry. It's incredibly influential both economically and politically in Arizona as it is elsewhere. And so we've also done a lot of work, just exposing it to sunlight. And that's kind of sometimes all you have to do because it's such an unusual thing to say, whoa, hey, are we saving money on this? Let's investigate. And because no one else has, suddenly I get to be an expert and go on trips to Iowa to talk about this stuff because I'm the only one who's bothered to ask if we're saving money, if these facilities are performing well, if they're making us safer, if they're rehabilitating people. And so what I've been doing at these talks is kind of giving the overview of this in terms of mass incarceration, which is suddenly, and to my delight, a conversation that we're finally having in this country about the fact that we are locking up more than any other country in the world and what that means and what it costs and what the impacts are and what the role of profit and for-profit entities is in that world, including in the world of criminalization, detention, and incarceration of immigrants. And I find it really frustrating that these have been separate conversations for so long, that, you know, we're talking about mass incarceration over here and we're talking about immigration over there, when to my mind it's actually the natural extension of a strategy of criminalization in this country that's, you know, been happening for, you know, about as long as we've been here. As you know, Iowa does not have private prisons. Keep it that way. And states vary widely in terms of whether or not they use privatization in prisons, right? So total about 130 private prisons in the country with about 157,000 people in them.
That was Carolyn Isaacs, who was in Iowa last week speaking about for-profit prisons and immigrant detention centers. Of course, the increased rates of incarceration that she mentioned can be in part attributed to the war on drugs and mandatory minimum sentences for relatively minor drug crimes, and some of that legislation is now being reversed. It's also been well documented that those policies have disproportionately impacted people of color in the criminal justice system, and that is true in Iowa as well. Carolyn Isaacs went on to explain how immigration violations have now become, to a very great extent, criminalized.
We take a behavior that we dislike, that we don't understand, that we fear, and the response is to criminalize it, right? And when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. It's our one response to just about everything. So drug addiction, mental illness, and now immigrations. Because if you think about it, immigration offenses, not having the proper paperwork, is generally a civil infraction. It's like you didn't register your car and you get pulled over. right? That's a civil infraction. However, we are putting people in facilities, in very prison-like facilities, for months, sometimes years on end, while they sort out their paperwork. In addition to that, we have actually formally criminalized the act of crossing the border. So the federal government actually created two laws. One is called unlawful entry. Unlawful entry, crossing the border, is a federal misdemeanor. Unlawful re-entry, crossing the border again, is a federal felony. And there is very selective enforcement of these criminal behaviors. Right? So some people are still going through the civil system, and some people, if you get caught in the wrong place, literally, if you're apprehended in the Tucson sector of the Border Patrol, you might be put through a program called Operation Streamline, where you are criminally prosecuted for these behaviors. If you're caught in San Diego, there is no such program. So think about it, right? Previously, home of the free, land of the brave, melting pot, immigrants are part of our fabric, right? Immigrants were not a feared group of individuals. And then you see this hype beginning and this rhetoric and this very deliberate application of this criminal label to the same behavior that I would wager all of our ancestors participated in, right? I can tell you my Welsh ancestors got off the boat to go work in the coal mines in northeast Pennsylvania, and they did not have any papers, right? But that was opportunity. That was making a better life for your family. That was not a criminal act at the time, right? Same behavior, new rhetoric, new label, and new laws that we create. And not for nothing either. So there's a heck of a lot of people now in these facilities. And these are the civil ones for the most part. So these are individuals waiting for that paperwork to sort out. People who are seeking asylum in this country, right? I fear for my life if I am returned to my home country. And that process of, you know, looking into their story, establishing that what they say is true, that they have a credible fear of violence if they're returned, and those who are just waiting to get deported. This sometimes lasts for years. In the meantime, a private company is making $159 a day on that person. There are family detention centers in this country where children, you know, little toddlers are walking around in a prison. I mean, the kids are just like sitting in there. You know, there aren't programs. They aren't set up to be prisons. They're not supposed to be prisons. Prisons are required to provide things like rehabilitation and jobs and programming for the inmates. Detention centers have none of that. They're just holding you.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We're listening to a presentation given last week by Caroline Isaacs from the American Friends Service Committee in Arizona. The title of her talk was Who Profits from Immigrant Detention and Mass Incarceration? In her talk, she explained that over 50% of the prison beds in the country are in private facilities, and she detailed the impact of lobbying by the corporations that build and run these prisons and immigration detention centers. The two largest of these corporations, she said, are CCA, the Correction Corporation of America, and another corporation called Geo Group. As an example of corporate influence on public policy, she talked about how the immigrant bed quota, which you might have heard of, came to be. In this excerpt, she mentions the DHS subcommittee in Congress. And just to be clear, DHS stands for the Department of Homeland Security.
This bed quota, have folks heard about the bed quota?
Yes.
So, yeah, the federal budget has a requirement that we pay for 34,000 immigrants to be locked up on any given day. Whether we have them in custody or not, that money will be paid, right? And as we know, half of it is going to these for-profit corporations, so that's a pretty sweet deal for them. And it's not by accident, right? So it's very hard to find out exactly where and who and how these corporations are lobbying. at the federal level, and it's even harder at the state level, believe me. But what we do know is when they feel like reporting what they're lobbying on, what they say is CCA spent, you know, over $10 million between 2008 and 2014 lobbying the U.S. Congress on immigration stuff. That includes opposing comprehensive immigration reform, which would be bad for business, as well as advocating for what they want. So we do know that about 61% of that was spent directly lobbying the DHS Appropriations Subcommittee. And what did the DHS Appropriations Subcommittee do? They put that quota in the budget. That's where it came from. Those are the guys that wrote that into the federal budget. So since we're in Iowa and it's that time, I wanted to highlight just a couple examples of the governing under the influence that we're talking about here. And I want to preface this by saying, first of all, down the bottom, this is not a partisan thing on the part of the corporations or on the part of AFSC, of course. They don't care, Democrat or Republican. Their strategy is to give money to whoever they think is going to win, because that's the person who is later going to be in a position to give them what they want, right? So they don't care about party affiliation or ideology or anything else. They give to, you know, there actually was an analysis done that showed, you know, like in most cases they give to incumbents because incumbents always win. You know, they're very smart about where they put their money.
After building the case for the extraordinary power that these corporations have, Caroline Isaacs painted a somewhat more hopeful picture that things might be changing. But even that hopefulness was tempered with caution.
And finally, one of my favorite stories of this current campaign is about Hillary Clinton. So Hillary accepted money early on from private prison companies. And somebody called her on it. And it got in the paper. And this was a huge embarrassment to her campaign. Right? That is a political liability now, where it hasn't been in the past. So exposing that fact and it getting into the paper was extremely controversial and embarrassing for her. So that's number one, like, wow, somebody actually cared. And it was an issue all of a sudden. She gave the money back. That's pretty cool. But she didn't stop there. Anybody know what she did next? Did you guys hear about this? She tweeted, "If I become president, I will outlaw for-profit incarceration. I will make for-profit incarceration illegal." Right? Tweets it out. You know what happened after that? CCA's stock took a dive. Her tweet influenced their corporate profit. And her tweet was the result of somebody like you digging up the dirt and calling her on it. It made a huge difference, not just in the dialogue around the campaign, but actually to their bottom line. And I'll tell you what, we are scary to them. So, you know, the fact that you are all in this room is a testament to the fact that this is moving and changing. I've been doing this for 15 years, and I tell you what, it's been a lonely road, people. I used to be the weirdest outlier on this stuff. It was the third rail of politics. You didn't talk about mass incarceration 15 years ago. You would have sounded like a lunatic, right? All of a sudden, we're having a national dialogue about this. It's in the news. Church groups are studying Michelle Alexander's book. You have the President of the United States talking about it. The Justice Department is taking it up. There's legislation in Congress. And since 2009, the vast majority of U.S. states have taken concrete steps to reduce their prison populations because they can't afford it, because they realized it wasn't working. And so out of that has grown a whole movement. There's new studies. There's like really, really good research, evidence-based practices for what works. It's not, you know, rocket science. It's not crazy anymore. There are proven models, and there are results. So you can look to a state and say, this state did XYZ reform. They saved X million dollars, and their crime rate went down, or their recidivism rate down went down by X much. So it's really concrete results that we're starting to see. So all of this, again, was unthinkable, and we know now about alternatives. But this movement is a huge threat to the for-profit prison industry, right? If all these states are reducing their prison populations, they're closing prisons in a lot of cases. The federal government is considering ending, detention or reducing detention. That's a big squeeze. Those are the two halves of their profits, right? So the industry is vulnerable. This huge behemoth of, you know, this political and economic juggernaut is very vulnerable, and they are vulnerable to people like you. We can really affect their corporate, you know, Hillary can kill them with a tweet, and we can talk to these candidates and get them to tweet. Here's one concern that we have, in spite, you know, this is the good news, things are moving, but these companies are not, they're no slouches, right? They've seen the writing on the wall, and they are marketers. So they're selling whatever they think you're buying. And so now they're selling us rehabilitation. They're selling us reentry programs. You want a halfway house instead of a prison? Sure, we'll run that for you. No problem. You want drug treatment? Yeah, okay. Alternatives to incarceration? Sure. We'll do that. So these companies have started not only like remarketing themselves with all this verbiage about, you know, rehabilitation, but their business strategies have changed. So they're now buying up all these smaller fish that run halfway houses. Geo Group bought BI Incorporated, that makes GPS ankle bracelet monitors for people on home arrest. And so getting back to the issue of family detention, and this hue and cry among immigration advocates across the country, these people shouldn't be in detention. It doesn't make any sense. And the Obama administration listened, right? And Obama said, we're going to look into alternatives to detention. Great. Guess what the alternative to detention is? GPS ankle bracelet monitors made by Geo Group. So Geo Group went from a contract to run an immigration detention center to a contract to put immigrants on some form of surveillance and supervision. And that is where I'm concerned that we may be headed with this. This is the cautionary tale of the moment that we're in, is that these folks are very well positioned to hijack the good work of sentencing reform activists and reformers of the immigration system for their own potential gain. And so just a quick plug, we have a document, a report on this called The Treatment Industrial Complex. And we can send you out a link to where to find that. But we look at these three different sectors and what it means. So the privatization of medical care, the privatization of state forensic mental health facilities, and civil commitment centers, and correctional supervision and alternatives to detention and incarceration. The concern there is net widening, that their profits are going to be driven by bringing more and more people into the system instead of pushing them out, which is what sentencing reform is about.
That was Carolyn Isaacs of the American Friends Service Committee and their initiative called Governing Under the Influence. She was in Iowa last week speaking about mass incarceration and the for-profit prison industry. Now we'll hear another song played by Kathleen Rohde from the ISU Department of Music. That was Kathleen Rohde from the ISU Music Department and also the director of the women's choirs at ISU, playing a beautiful rendition of Silent Night, just her on the piano. This is KHOI, and you've been listening to Local Talk. On our show today, we heard from Christopher Rollins and Emily Lang, two teachers in the Des Moines Public Schools who started a program called Run DSM. They spoke recently to students in the teacher ed program at ISU. And we also heard from three of their students who performed poems that they wrote. The students were James Reesby, Jaleesha Johnson, and Elandra Brazel. We also heard from Carolyn Isaacs of the American Friends Service Committee in Arizona. She spoke about the role of corporations in the private prison and detention center industry. And that's it for today. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also listen to today's Local Talk show and all of our past shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There, you will also find information about the people and organizations that you heard about today on the show, along with contact info and other links that they mentioned. Local Talk was engineered by Jonah DeGeest. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other songs we heard were piano performances done by Kathleen Rohde from the ISU Music Department. KHOI is a community radio station that is driven by volunteers and made possible by donations from individuals, businesses, and organizations in the community. We just completed our fall membership drive. If you didn't become a member or you forgot to make a pledge, it's not too late. Do it now. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.